Hello and welcome back to the Dive and Dig News Podcast. This week we are going deep, very deep. I will be exploring deep water archaeology with two extremely experienced ladies, Franca Cicabini and Barbara David. They are going to tell us all about the challenges of discovering and documenting shipwrecks at depth.
So, ladies, it's great to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure too. Yeah. I have Barbara David, who is the, well, not so new now, head of underwater archaeology, Superintendenza, which I probably mispronounced, for Italy. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And Franca
Cicabini.
Yeah, that one. Who is a very eminent person working in the Drasma, who seems to be working on many, many, many shipwrecks simultaneously. And the session that you both chaired in the Under the Mediterranean 2 conference that we're very much enjoying here in Malta is the deep water archaeology session, which when you think about it, there's a little bit of me that thinks it's quite remarkable that we're actually having a session on deep water archaeology. I'm just wondering initially what your thoughts on that, because maybe 10, 15 years ago, archaeologists wouldn't have been in that privileged position. So do you have any thoughts on why, how we've got here, what's allowed us to actually access maritime objects, archaeology, shipwrecks at those great depths?
Yeah. If I can start.
As you want.
I can say that underwater archaeology in the deep sea is becoming an increasingly frequent theme in our activities. The activity of preventive archaeology required by our legislation, for example, before and during the construction of offshore energy facilities and installations, is increasing the number of new archaeological sites. And in Italy, I can say that now underwater archaeologists are present during the activities, and thanks to this, my Ministry of Culture, my new Superintendenza Nazionale per il Patrimonio Culturale Subacqueo, can protect and can study this new deep site. Thanks to new technologies that are increasing and going better and better during the year. And Franca, I think that she knows very well.
For us, as we, I work too for a Ministry of Culture in France, but we had the same problem. I mean, we have the new management with, for example, cable, underwater cable, which is a very important new, how I can say, emergence for us, for the rescue archaeology. But not also, we have now a technology who permits to, which permits to investigate quite easily, quite is it's not easy, it's better than 10, 15 years ago. Now we have robots, we have in the Drasm, we have ships who can put robots in the water. That it was not the case 15 years ago. And we realized quite early at Drasm, also in Italy, in the 2000 years, that shipwreck at in deep water were a very treasure for the future. We think that we thought at that time that it was a treasure for future archaeologists, but now we know that this is not so completely true, because we have lots of problems, lots of dangers, like the troll fishing.
Okay, and so on. So before we move on to the challenges, can we just sort of, when we say deep, what sort of depths are we talking about?
This is a very good question.
The first deep is over 50 meters. 50 meters is the deep that you can dive normally with
scuba
dive. After, there is another how can I say, trench of about till some 120, more or less. Mm-hmm. That it's the deep that you can dive, a man can dive with mixed gas.
Yeah.
Or a breather. And after, as we say, it's the royal. No.
Yeah.
The kingdom of ROV, robots.
Yeah, exactly.
Robots or submarine.
Yeah.
So we start from, from 130, you start to need to have really ROV or AOV or...
Yeah, so submarine. Remotely operated vehicles that are being deployed from ships. So in terms of, I know you've both been working on these deep water wrecks, amongst other things. Mm-hmm. So what's the deepest wreck that you've actually examined?
Concerning me, I examined a wreck 780 deep.
Wow.
Yeah, 780 meters deep. Mm. So, and it's my maximum, but
Jasmine, we work on Danton, which is a shipwreck of the First World War, who
lie
at 1,025 meters depth of Sardinia.
And so, because in order to document ships at that depth and to deploy your ROV, you need quite big machinery, don't you, to deploy that. So the other thing is about the size of the vessel that is deploying. Is that a problem as well, or do you think technology is helping with, lighter, more easily deployable equipment?
If I can say something. In general, for work at this depth, have to do a very accurate documentation. At the moment, you need a big ROV and very important technology that need a big ship to put the ROV underwater.
So you're talking about detailed documentation.
Yes, detail.
Yeah.
But or digging or taking
excavation.
It's about 10 years, 8-10 years, that all the university engineers are developing ROV, not too expensive and useful for do a documentation, simple documentation, but easy to have. And I think that the technicians have understand how important it is for us, for the underwater archaeologists and for the biologists, because it's not only the study of the site, but of the environment.
Absolutely.
Because the site and the archaeological site and the environment are together in the same place. They are a whole, no? So the expert in other technologies, in these technologies, have understand this, understand very well that we need new tools. So I see that I saw that in the European project, for example, there are a lot of projects funded by European Union. To develop new ROV and submarine, less expensive.
So, because that was something else, coming from the UK, where we're no longer in the European Union, we don't have access to these pockets of money, but that was something else. It's not cheap to do these sorts of... But obviously, both of you have mentioned that a lot of the survey work you've been doing as representatives of the government is part of, exploration in advance of whether it's cables, oil and gas. So So some of the development of the equipment is being done through universities and research, but the actual costs of deploying equipment and doing these surveys, is that coming from... is it development-led or... Is it the developers that are paying for it?
For us, yes, because we developed our ROV, for example, and we have our oceanographic ship. Because we do a lot of this activity to have a map of all these shipwrecks, because we have to protect also these shipwrecks not only to study and to
valorize yes, yeah.
them, but also to protect them. Yeah. And you can't protect something that you don't know where is, the yeah. exact position, the configuration. You can't, you don't know if there is a looting or if a troll destroy a partly of a shipwreck. Yeah. If you don't know what its shape before, so it's
There were some really quite shocking images that we've seen of trawlers and that some of the damages that can be done. So when you're on your vessel, you lucky things, because I don't have one. You're there. You're undertaking the survey. What? How do you literally go about it? I mean, you're deploying your ROV. What equipment does the ROV have on board? How are you documenting these shipwrecks?
Well, concerning, if I can answer to the previous question, so I can answer now to this. Concerning Italy, we don't have a ship, we don't have the equipment as the DRASM in France. We are a new office, a new institution, but we work together with the Navy, for example, and we use the equipment of the Navy. Or sometimes we work together with other institutions, and we are going to sign a protocol with DRASM just to study deep site together, for example. So this is because we don't have, we cannot do alone. We open new net with other institutions, so Italian institution like Navy or foreign institution. And when we decide to explore a depth site, we choose when and how to document the site, but before we have to plan the activities, because it's very expensive activities, and so it's important to have very well the idea of what we want to do, and so the program of the activities is very strict.
Yeah.
And so the first activities, but Franca can describe better than me, I think, is to do a first tour of the site to understand the limit,
the full dimension,
of the site. And so we have the first video and pictures, and then to do the 3D relief.
Listeners. No, you're fine. You're brilliant. This is great. No, please don't apologize. Because not all our. You say you're doing a video, but where is this video?
The video is on the ROV.
It's on the remotely operated vehicle. So this little machine's going around.
Normally, you have to decide before what you want to do.
Yeah.
In any case, because you have not the same tools, you don't use the same tools if you want to do, for example, a video for a reportage or for the TV or to be nice, because you have an angle of vision which is different from the angle of vision that you need, for example, to make a photogrammetry survey. So normally you make, as Barbara said, a little tour to have an idea of the site, and after, if you what you want to do and what you have also to do this. If you have only one camera, you have to decide what is the inclination of the camera of the or the photograph of the video. It depends. If you have more camera and video, for example, Arthur, our last ROV has had two places for camera, one for video and one for camera, so we can do the two at the same time. This is the best, but this is new, for example, for us. Before we had only one camera positioned in front of the ROV, and we couldn't change the inclination, so we have to get out the ROV, ROV, change the inclination. And this is not it's not a little movement.
Well, especially when you're down at 1,000 and you've got to, and it's costing, the top clock's going and it's costing you money.
This is the problem sometimes when I show our research. everything seems easy. Mm. And as I said, it's easy for, because 10 years ago it was impossible for me. But now it's easy, but it's not easy because every task we made it could take hours. Mm. To change a position of the camera could take hours. Mm. To change some piece, hours. Mm. And so very long, and you have also often problem, little problem, but you need to the robotic engineer work all the night often during the mission.
Yeah, you often see them with their like blurry eyes, don't you?
Yeah.
Sort of looking at screens, particularly when you're exploring for sites, because you can be there for weeks sometimes. But so Kate, you've got your photographs or maybe even photogrammetry, I guess, in some cases. Now, on one of the lectures that we saw, you had this amazing thing that came out and had like a sucky instrument, and you were able to lift some of the amphoras. Yes, sampling purposes. So how does that work?
Recover some artifacts or sampling the cargo. It's one of the most important activities because it's important for us to know the site, to see the site in general. But sometimes we need to recover some samples and objects to study in deep the artifacts and the site, of course. So, concerning my experience, we have used a system in 2019 to recover the part of the cargo of this early archaic wreck in the channel of Otranto.
That's the 7th century BC one. 7th
century BC,
one.
Yes. It's a very interesting site.
No, absolutely.
From an archaeological point of view. And we use this tool, is a pump, an air pump, that can bring the artifacts thanks to the air and positioning very slowly the object in a basket. And then the basket was recovered by the tool.
Now that must be pretty exciting when it comes out of the water and you're just like.
And it was very.
Is there going to be anything in it?
It's like a baby. Each object is like a baby that go out from the.
Yeah, well, because you want it to be lifted safely, don't you? I mean, apart from anything else, because it's as you said, there are lots of things that can go wrong.
For us, it's. Again, it's a little different because we have tested this kind of tools, but we were not very satisfied. Mm-hmm. So in the last year, we start a project, and partly also an Italian university of Pisa that work about a construction of a hand. A hand like a hand of an archaeologist to take like the one, not really exactly the one that Ocean One, the humanoid robot's head, but a hand with five fingers. And the idea is, it was, that this hand should have the same sensation. You can touch and recognize the objects with the touch.
And that sensation feeling comes up through to the operator.
This is one of the projects that the robotics we work with RASM are developing now. Yeah. And to come back to when you talk about how we proceed. If I can summarize, in our experience, we have planned for this. We planned deep water archaeology. I mean that we haven't done something like we have this opportunity, we go and we do something, like what we have done more or less all the people during the 90s and the 2000 period years, like Ballard and McCann, like. Look long on some shipwrecks in France and so on, but we have tried to do something methodology.
It's much more systematic.
We start with the documentation. Documentation means video, photogrammetry, And after, which is the site more in danger or more interesting? This one. So in this one, we will start to sampling. Or now we start to digging and documenting and so on. But it's something planning, not only to...
No, it's not reactive. Yeah. You're being proactive and structured and, Well, and obviously, as you said, there's also...
It's a new era, I think.
No,
to simplify.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
The archaeologists need, the underwater archaeologists need time to think about it. Also, thanks to the new technology, probably for us it's easier instead of the people that worked before us. But I think that this new generation of underwater archaeologists has the mentality, a new mentality, a new approach to do the research, a multidisciplinary research, and the mentality to plan everything and to do these activities in a scientific method, not as a pioneer. Yes, the pioneers are important, of course, but I think that at this moment we have to do the science, not the so, and we can because we have the methodology, we know how to do, and we have the technology that help us to do this. And also, it's not the case of deep underwater archaeology, but for example, I tested and we have designed together with some engineers from Pisa, a ROV to do the maintenance of and cleaning of underwater structures, Roman underwater structures in Baie.
In shallow water.
We have planned and designed this ROV to do the cleaning.
Well, it's like one of those automatic hoovers that you let go in your house and they go around.
The concept is the same. Someone asked me, but why you need to spend a lot of money to design this ROV to clean, to do something that a man can do in a minute.
For the same reason that you have an automatic hoover in your home.
But there is another answer too, because to clean a wall or a mosaic, you have to control the stronger of the tools that to do the cleaning. So thanks to this project, the engineering have designed a hand that can clean and can control. They control
the amount of pressure you're putting on it.
Yes, and they can now they use this tool for another activities, not for a restoration. But thanks to our experience, we give to the engineering the idea, we inspire them to do something else. Yeah. So this is
Definitely. And I think there's been a history of that, hasn't there? Archaeologists have certain needs, and so they go and talk to the engineers knowing that they can't fulfill their needs because they don't have enough cash. And then the engineers are like, yes, let's explore it. And then we've got new methodologies. And it's really... So... I've heard, mostly through your session and previously, but, you know, some of these wrecks are remarkably well preserved because of the nature, I guess, of the way they wreck and the depths. And is that that's your experience? There's lots of smiling faces, so I'm assuming.
Some of them are really, really well preserved. Others, no. No, they start to be destroyed, but in general... Also, when they are partially endangered by trawlers.
Fishing trawlers. But it sounds to me like the issue is that when they hit the seabed 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, whatever, I don't know what to generalise, but there's a likelihood that their preservation could be better, but it's the subsequent human interaction. And
this the human interaction, but not only. We are accustomed to ship who arrive at the coast. When you arrive at the coast... The shipwreck, it's very, very violent. It's not the same things if you are brought to the rocky coast by the wind, and the ship is completely destroyed just on arriving at the coast. When you sank in a very deep water and you arrive in a bottom which is with sand or very, very poof, the ship runter a little bit in the sand. It's not really sand, but a vase.
Muddy sand, but
the momentum. Probably they put him in a different position
it moves around a bit.
And after, the destruction is the same like at 20 meters, but in a very quiet environment, without wave, without anything. This is also preserved shipwreck, and the underwater organism. Like, for example, Teredo Navale is not active. Like,
so that's the shipworms, not so active at depth.
And a lot of these factors are less intrusive than in shallow water.
That's this really interesting, isn't it? Really interesting. And I mean, it makes sense, but I hadn't thought of it.
As Barbara said before, now this is a new era also because we start, we work with other colleagues of other discipline, and we work a lot with biologists. We start to work a lot with biologists. Because when my experience was that when I show my work on a shipwreck, there is a biologist who says, "Oh, wow, this is fantastic! We have not all these images about all these species of organisms and so on."
Colonize the site, and the leave on the site using as a substrate the site. So. Yes, it is, and it's very interesting also that underwater, also so deep, you can find some very small pieces and very fragile artifacts like glass, for example. A lot of glasses are. It's strange, but it's true.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it? Because you'd think all such depth, everything.
Or also, we have found, for example, olive stones. Inside the amphora and in the sediment inside the amphora, our expert have analyzed also the pulp of the olive that is well preserved so deep in the sea. Probably the anaerobic environment help this.
No oxygen.
The anaerobic environment is present also at 20 meters. It not depends on the depth, but when you think at a wreck of something that you discover at 700 meters, 800 meters, you think that never can be preserved. No, it's not true. You can find a lot. That's why it's important to document well and to recover slowly, because otherwise you are going to lose a lot of information. So if you are not sure, it's better to leave there, don't touch, and waiting for another opportunity, another period when the technology will be better and the new archaeologists can work on
it. I think on that message, Barbara, I couldn't agree more. That's as you say, it's technology. We've got to wait to catch up if we need a bit more to help us. But that was so interesting. Thank you both very much. And I'm really looking forward to the next Mediterranean and to the Mediterranean conference so we can find out more about what's been going on. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
That was brilliant.
Thank you.
That was so much fun and really demonstrates how technology is driving our discipline forward with a bit of help from the offshore industries. And I'm so delighted that women are leading the way. Thanks for listening to the Dive and Dig podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports the development of maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. Thanks for listening, and hopefully you'll join us again soon. Bye.